Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So day three of the French Open, all the first round matches pretty much are done and dusted, apart from Pauline Parmentier and Veronika Kudermetova, who at 9:33 French time are just taking to court for their first round match. But there are no night sessions at the French Open, no night sessions at all. It was a little bit warmer today, according to the weather forecast. Was it, Matt and David, any less weird?
I thought in the first few hours of the day, it was considerably less weird. And It was a little bit more like, you know how, Matt, we had that one day at the US Open when suddenly it felt like a Grand Slam? There was a period for a few hours there where it felt like a Grand Slam. And I think it was because we had that really good match on the main court, the Châtrier court, with Karolina Pliskova having her work cut out. And simultaneously, I'd got my heart in my mouth about Jennifer Brady because of predictions problems. And, well, that didn't work out too well. But there was lots going on all at the same time. That's the key, isn't it, really, to it feeling like a Grand Slam. And it felt like there was energy everywhere. And there were tweets flying everywhere. And the WhatsApp group was going bonkers. Oh, it was great fun. I mean, kind of, except that all my predictions just were a disaster.
Did you get Grand Slam vibes, Matt?
I did, yes, but I don't want to talk too much about that when we can talk about David's prediction.
Okay, hang on. Predictions plural. How many fell by the wayside today?
Well, my daily predictions in the newsletter, which we put out every day, folks. So subscribe if you want to laugh at me some more. You can do that in there. I'm 0-3 now. And not only that, I went for Madison Brengel to beat Yelena Ostapenko, and she lost 6-2, 6-1. And Yelena Ostapenko was pictured returning Madison Brengel's serve nearly inside the service box.
It was majestic.
Well. Yeah.
And what I particularly loved about it is that Yelena Ostapenko's second serve is not up to much. So it's a pretty baller move for her to, she's kind of inviting, it's kind of a people in glass houses situation, read the second serve. If I were Madison Brengel, I didn't see much of that match, but I would have trolled her right back and stood it even closer to return her second serve. ended up just volleying.
It's where I would imagine you would stand if your opponent said to you, I'm going to do an underarm drop shot serve now. And that's where I would stand, to give you an idea. So I kind of thought that Brengel's choppy game would drive Ostapenko to distraction, but instead Ostapenko just got a massive fly swatter and knocked her into the middle of next week. And then the other prediction that went horribly wrong.
Well, hang on, very quickly, while we're on Ostapenko, we should probably mention the only other time she's ever won a match at Roland Garros, she's gone on to win the tournament. So maybe Ostapenko should start featuring in your predictions, David.
And I really hope she does now go on to win the tournament, because that was my favourite stat. Her 0 wins at the French Open, 0 wins at the French Open, 7 wins at the French Open, 0 wins at the French Open, 0 wins at the French Open. I just loved that stat so much.
Yeah, if all today has done is ruined that stat, then...
I mean,
yeah,
she would feature in my predictions hereafter if I wasn't going to predict that Clara Tawson was going to win every match in eternity forever.
She's your femme du jour, is she now?
Well, now that she's just ruined my entire fortnight by beating Jennifer Brady, despite Brady having 2 match points and fighting all the way back and letting me down. Let's be serious about Tawson for a minute. This is a 17-year-old who I must admit I don't think I'd ever seen play tennis before. She was an Australian Open champion in the juniors in 2019. I wonder, Matt, do you remember covering her at all back then when you were there? Because that would have been when you were focusing on the juniors. But, I mean, she beat, in the final, she beat Leila Fernandez, the promising Canadian. But whereas I've seen Fernandez on the circuit, I have not seen this young woman play before. And, I mean, I like Fernandez, but this woman's game is breathtaking in its power off both sides. I really was struggling to believe what I was seeing.
Yeah, me too. I have to be honest, I had not seen her play at all, I don't think, until today. This was my introduction to her, and I now have very high expectations. I think, like you, David, every time we see her play, this will unfairly probably will be the standard that we judge her against. I mean, she said herself this was the best match she's ever played in her life, so we probably should temper those expectations a little bit. But as you said, what an exciting game. Just force off both wings and sustained force, but also in one of the biggest matches of her life, in a very tense match, going back and forth. She was so controlled and calm about it. There was one little wobble where she had a couple of match points and let them slip, but she immediately regrouped. And I just...
She was just toying with David, Matt.
She really was. I mean, I really felt for you, David, actually, in that sort of half an hour, because there was a moment where I think it looked like Jennifer Brady was going to win, and you were saved. This prediction featuring in part 3 of our worst tennis podcast predictions of all time podcast, which I'm sure we will be doing at one stage or other in the future, and this one will be featuring now, because, as I said, the way Tawson managed to regroup after briefly letting it slip was, to me, just as impressive as the way she played most of the match, kind of just going for it and not having to cope with nerves. The fact that she then did have a little slip actually made it all the more impressive, I think, that she managed to win.
And Brady did not play badly
at all.
It was such a high-quality match. So few points were decided by errors. Really was high quality.
I had a look at the time, side-by-side stats between the Pliskova match and this one with Brady. And, I mean, in the first set, for instance, Brady hit 10 winners. Not a bad number of winners. And she lost that set. Tawson hit 18 in the same set. And by the end of it, Tawson had hit well over 40 winners, and Brady had hit a good 30-something herself, and more winners than unforced errors. And usually, if you do that, you pretty much are likely to win. And that's the sort of match we were looking at. And what really struck me was some of the other matches we've seen this week and at the US Open, it's more this week because of the extended final set, I found myself wanting some of these matches to end. I wanted that 18-16 match to end with Mute the other day and have a tie break. I didn't want this to end. I wanted it to end 6-love to Brady. But in terms of what I was watching, it was so good. It reminded me of that middle-of-the-night match with Brady and Osaka, and then the one that followed with Azarenka and Serena Williams. Just the quality was really uplifting. I just wanted it to carry on and on and on. But the fact that Tawson stood up to this and was still the aggressor, she took everything that Brady had got. And I still can't quite believe it, how good she was for somebody of 17.
Just on that final set point, and whether you wanted a tie break or it to go on. I've been thinking about this, and it seems another situation where, because you've got best of three in the women's and best of five in the men's, I actually think what I prefer is probably dependent on that. And best of five, I really like a tiebreak, especially a 10-point tiebreak. I think I've enjoyed that at the Australian Open the last 2 years. It feels like an exclamation point on the match, and we've seen some really good, dramatic 10-point tiebreaks at the Australian Open. And after five sets, frankly, I'm often ready for the match to end and have this crescendo. But I think it's different when you're just talking about best of three. And I think it's a shame at the Slams, which do have a tie break in best of three, because it almost feels like you're cutting the match short. But here, the fact that they play on felt perfect for best of three. So I think we've had a couple of years now with these different formats for the final set, and I've not been sure how I felt about it. And something this tournament has crystallized in my mind, and that feels like my definitive position: tiebreak for five sets and continue for best of three sets.
Absolutely, I'm aboard with that. It feels completely arbitrary that the men's and the women's are on the tiebreak front treated equally at Slams. I mean, I think they should be playing the same format across the board, and therefore the same tiebreak rule should apply across the board. But if you're not going to want or allow that to happen, then yeah, absolutely, I'm totally on board for that. So Clara Tawson, she's going to win the tournament now, David? Is that what you're saying?
Well, until I found out it was the best match she's ever played in her whole life, yes, she was. But I really hope that she can back this up, A, to save me a little bit of humiliation, and B, to just give something to build on. I mean, look, she's so young. There's no need to go silly about the hype. Obviously, I am. But, you know, I feel it would be great if she could win a couple of matches here now and just put a bit of a run together, because it's already there. The basics of the easy power is so clearly there, and she did other things well. It'd be nice to see if she has it in her to repeat.
She is the exact opposite of Caroline Wozniacki as a tennis player, isn't she? The two, kind of the only two famous Danish tennis players, if you can call Clara Tawson famous. David's trying to make her famous. yeah, she's a huge hitter. Movement's her weakness. Big forehand. Backhand is the weaker wing.
Likes clay. I
mean, likes clay, yeah. It could not be more different, Caroline.
You came to that match probably two-thirds of the way through, didn't you, Catherine? I know I was then commentating on something else, and I just suddenly noticed you were massively invested in it. What was it about her that liked?
Well, I always like seeing a name that I've been aware of in juniors. I'd never seen her play before, but just like I remember the first time I saw Tsitsipas and Felix Auger-Aliassime and Shapovalov and Coco Gauff, and I think to a slightly lesser extent, but a little bit with Cece Bellis, I always remember names, significant names from juniors, and kind of make a mental note. It'd be interesting to see them play. And this was the first time I had seen her play. And I also noted that she had qualified. I almost picked this one for my daily prediction, but I got lured into a Sloane Stephens situation that was a creek without a paddle.
Daniel Collins is her next opponent.
Oh, can we talk about Danielle Collins?
Go for it.
She played Monica Niculescu today, which, I mean, is a nightmare at the best of times, I think. But today, Monica Niculescu, she was very much down in the score, wasn't she? And she was in kitchen sink territory, Niculescu, against Danielle Collins. And she throws in the underarm serve, and it's a perfectly good underarm serve, but Danielle Collins is on it. She rushes up to the service box. She's right there with the return. She hits it. She controls it beautifully. So often players go long with a return off an underarm serve because they're struggling to control their speed up to the ball, and they get too far underneath it. But beautiful service return winner off an underarm serve, and the noise that she released was, I mean, it was just my spirit in a vocalization.
Can we hear it?
Yeah, let's. It's so great. I know she rubs people up the wrong way. I'm absolutely certain she would rub me up the wrong way if I were her opponent. But I just love how unfiltered she is. It's like Medvedev yesterday saying, "I was trying to win the point, man," to Vucevic. Like, yeah, it's just own it. If you're gonna be that kind of competitor, just own it and embrace it.
I wonder what it'll be like if she tries. Well, she probably will try all that sort of stuff against the 17-year-old Danish girl.
She tries it against everyone.
Poor girl.
So that's the thing. It's unfiltered. She doesn't make any compromises on herself for other people on a tennis court. And as much as that is deeply irritating, it's also very impressive, I think. And I think she wins matches because of it. I really do. I think she wins matches that she wouldn't otherwise without being that irritating. So Clara Tawson is the next opponent for Danielle Collins. Mental note to make sure I watch that one. Just going back to my dodgy prediction for today, the reason why you lured me into thinking Sloane Stephens would lose was because that match was, I think, second on court 14. Against
Dyachenko, wasn't it?
Vitalia Dyachenko, yeah. And she's not a court 14, crowdless French Open player, is she, Sloane Stephens? I think that is... I didn't see any of it, but I think that's quite a statement, looking at that scoreline, that she was able to do that, you know, on an outside court in pretty dodgy conditions. You know, we all know what her tennis is capable of.
I agree. I was concerned about that as well. 2-2 is a good result for her there. That's the thing, isn't it? She's somebody who needs to play her way into the tournament and mm-hmm. get on centre court, and then anything is possible, and anything needs to be possible. Given I've got her in the semis.
I think I've got her in the quarters, so I was hedging today. Anyway,
she is just a predictions nightmare, Sloane Stephens. Whenever I see her in the draw, I have a sort of crisis of about half an hour deciding whether or not I actually think she will perform what she's capable of doing at these tournaments. And this tournament, I decided against it. I think I've gone with Petra Martic instead, someone who's just a bit steadier, and you just know a little bit more what you're going to get. But if they were to meet on a given day and Sloane Stephens was to play her best, I'm sure Sloane Stephens would win. So it just makes it very, very difficult. So I just generally try and steer clear of having to make Sloane Stephens predictions.
I still think Sloane Stephens' best tennis is pretty much the best tennis.
It's right up there.
It's right up there. I'd put Osaka on a hard court and Andreescu is on a hard court, as much as that feels like a slightly distant memory. But yeah, I think it is. It's in the conversation. It's just we so rarely see it. But yeah, you mentioned, David, the match that opened things up on Châtrier between Karolina Plíšková, the injured second seed, or I say injured, we assumed she was coming into this tournament heavily hampered after seeing her in the final of Rome, retiring from that match against Simona Halep, barely able to move, even though Matt couldn't detect any difference between that Plíšková and the normal Plíšková. So I think people were maybe expecting, you know, a slightly turbulent performance from Plíšková today. And I suppose just looking at the scoreline, you could think that was the story of the match. She was playing Maya Sharif, the first Egyptian woman to play in a Grand Slam tournament, having qualified in Paris. And she did win through Plíšková 6-7, 6-2, 6-4. But the story of the match, I didn't see every point of it, but the story of the match was not injured Plíšková, was it, by any stretch of the imagination? In fact, she didn't even have any strapping on her thigh today.
Yeah, and she said in her press conference that it's fine. She said it's not 100%, but it's fine. And she kind of did that thing where she said that all tennis players always have little niggles that they're having to deal with. And, you know, we think back to just a few weeks ago, Naomi Osaka won the US Open with a niggle. So that is certainly something that these players can play through. So I agree that wasn't the story of the match. For me, there were two stories. It was Maya Sharif really impressing. I thought she was really fun to watch on that Grand Slam stage for the first time. And she saved 8 set points in the first set and just grabbed it on a tie break. And it was a fascinating contrast because they were just at opposite ends of all the spectrums in terms of their emotion on the court. Pliskova was kind of lifeless and a bit flat for most of it. I know she made this comeback, but it wasn't exactly stirring. It was just her being the better player, I think, ultimately.
Name me a time, Matt, when you would have described Pliskova as stirring.
When she cracked her racket onto that umpire's chair. Yes.
But that's kind of what I mean. It felt like I'd seen this match before from Pliskova many, many times. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary for her at a Grand Slam, and that's why I wouldn't read too much into it in terms of it being a particularly significant result for her. I think she's going to have to do quite a lot more to progress deep into this tournament. She's just so curious because she will win, she'll string points together and look completely unbeatable, and then string points together and look like she can't find the court. And I just find her very, very difficult to put my finger on as a tennis player and work out how she's actually doing. But she came through and she was very upfront about her level, saying that it wasn't anything to write home about. And actually, you know, she was not impressed with herself. You know, she's very honest like that, Pliskova. So it's always worth, I think, checking her transcript after she's done a press conference in case there's a little gem in there. Someone asked her about her second serve and she just said, "Next question, please." and then there wasn't a next question. That was the end of the press conference.
My favourite bit about when she crashed the umpire's chair with a racket in Rome a couple of years ago was that when her opponent Maria Sakkari was standing right next to her and nearly jumped out of her skin. She had no idea that was about to happen.
No, it was like all of Pliskova's sort of the still waters running deep, all of the depths emerged in that one moment and never to be seen again. Maybe it's all just simmering there.
Sharif is a great story, though, isn't she? Just as a human interest story, for a start. As you were saying there, Catherine, first Egyptian woman in a Grand Slam tournament. And, I mean, that could be a hugely inspirational story for another generation to follow.
Absolutely. I hope that match was available on terrestrial Egyptian TV and frankly TV throughout the Arab world. I think that, you know, there is a lot of solidarity in that part of the world. I know Ons Jabeur receives a lot of support in when she plays in Dubai, for example. You know, it's pretty unusual to see an Arab man or woman having success on the court. There are a lot of reasons for that. There's not the infrastructure and the federations in place to provide support for junior tennis players. I believe in some parts of those regions, it is particularly difficult for female athletes to get any kind of structural support or, you know, any kind of support really to get on the path to turning professional. So I just really hope that was visible today to young girls, young boys and girls, but in particular young girls, because who knows what this will turn into? Really, who knows? But she really looked like the real deal, didn't she? She really looked like a proper professional tennis player that belonged on that stage.
She didn't look 172 great athlete. In the world,
she was not cowed by the occasion. No. As you say, Matt, those set points saved. She was really something today. And I hope we do see her again.
And I think she'll be especially good on clay. She really rips her forehand with loads and loads of topspin. It's one of those what you think's going out and it dips in at the last minute. And that was yet another contrast with Pliskova in this match as well. And it just made for a really good watch, I thought. And she really felt and performed like she belonged on that court. And I was also reading that she's received quite a lot of support from Mo Salah, who has kind of reached out and kind of tried to use, you know, the huge platform that he's got to kind of spread the word about her. And I don't know whether they've actually spoken, but I think she's really appreciated that. And that, I think, bodes well for getting, as you said, Catherine, getting that visibility of what she's achieved just by qualifying and playing in the first round of this main draw. It's a big deal.
Oh, that's so heartwarming.
One of the players as well who got the ITF grant recently announced for the Grand Slam, from the Grand Slam Fund. And so, you know, I think it's 20,000 or something like that. So that makes a big difference.
Elsewhere in the women's tournament today, Sophia Kenin was really on the ropes, wasn't she? That could have been game over for Sophia Kenin against Samsonova, Lyudmila Samsonova, 125 in the world. Kenin's been pretty honest, hasn't she, since the tour's resumption, even in New York, about the fact that she's not really feeling it.
And it looks like she's struggling with it a bit, actually.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing.
It's difficult for her to... She hasn't got a kind of control sample to know how much of that is about being Grand Slam champion and playing with everything that comes with that. How much of it is about the pandemic? How much of it is about there being no crowds and everything being weird? How much of it is the conditions being different? I can imagine her head must be a bit of a jumble at the moment, and just her life changed immeasurably. At the same time, the world changed beyond recognition. Yeah, I mean, what a time for Sophia Kenin. I was impressed that she fought through that today, but she's an interesting case study.
Well, at the end of it, she said, "I won. It was ugly, but it doesn't matter if it's ugly." It was almost like listening to Brad Gilbert talking about winning tennis matches. But I don't know Sophia Kenin. I haven't heard her talk enough to fully feel sure about this. But I suspect there may be a little bit of the Angelique Kerber's about the way she's feeling right now in the aftermath of having won big. As you said, her life has changed, but I also think her perception of her life having changed and her position in the game is even bigger than maybe it really is. And I think she has this perception that all eyes are on her in a way that actually they're not really. In when you know when we're at these tournaments, she is a Grand Slam champion. She's in the draw, but she's not the feature of attention. But the way she was talking in her mind, it seems that that's what she's feeling, and that can be itself problematic. And I think it's also exacerbated by the fact that she's so desperate to win. She's so desperate to succeed. I mean, this is not a player who won a Grand Slam and thought, right, that's great, I'll have a lovely life now, and if I do well, great, if not, not to worry. She's driven, and she only knows one way: 100% full throttle all the time, try and win, and if I don't win, I'm not going to be happy. And I just wonder whether that balance is probably quite hard to strike for her. You know, it's a learning process, because a bit like the Ostapenko win, it came out of the blue, really. And I think, unlike with a Dominic Thiem who's just methodically made his way into the final and got closer in the next final and closer in the next final, then won one, and he's kind of got used to it as he's gone along. When you win out of the blue like that, you're not really ready, are you?
Yeah, you're right. It's interesting. I don't think, actually, externally, us lot and tennis pundits and observers and watchers have adjusted our expectations of Sophia Kenin as much as she thinks of it. I mean, I looked at that today and thought, oh, she could lose. I know nothing about Samsonova. I didn't know her first name until, you know, 2.5 minutes ago. But I thought she could lose that today, and that wouldn't be... Bit like Vondrousova yesterday, we would mention it, but it wouldn't be our lead story. But I think I get the impression, exactly as you said, David, maybe in her mind, she thinks that would be kind of seismic, you know, Australian Open champion. And I guess there are so many kind of templates of players that have had that big success and failed to live up to it. You know, Ostapenko, as you say, is the most obvious one, although, as we've established, she's definitely going to go on and win the title again this year. And again, as you say, I'm just repackaging all the brilliant analysis you've just done, but she doesn't want to be that. I think she's so desperate not to be that flash in the pan, that player that people go, oh yeah, do you remember that weird time when Sofia Kenin won a Grand Slam? That was weird, wasn't it? She doesn't want to be Thomas Johansson.
It was all right to be Thomas Johansson because he did it, you know, when he was a good age in a way. He was, it was out of the blue.
I think Thomas Johansson is absolutely fine being Thomas Johansson. But Sofia Kenin wouldn't be.
No.
I mean, it is all very interesting, though, because I do agree that we're not, you know, we haven't got these sky-high expectations of Sofia Kenin that we think we might have as someone who's just become a Grand Slam champion. But the very fact that we're having this discussion now does show that something has changed, because last year we wouldn't be talking about a round one win at the French Open for Sofia Kenin. Mm. So there definitely has been a shift.
Of course it's changed.
But I think you're right that it's bigger in her mind than it is in reality, I think. I mean, there has been a change, but just not a huge one. But also, I think it's probably the change I expected. She felt sustainable to me after the Australian Open. I thought she wouldn't be a flash in the pan. But I also didn't expect her to win multiple Grand Slams over the next few years. I thought she would be someone who would compete and contend and kind of make the most of what she's got. And I still believe she will do that.
That's why her 6-love loss to Azarenka the other week was so jarring, because this is a player who's always there. You know, she gives you a hard day. If you might win, but you know you've been in a battle. Well, so that was very, very jarring.
Last couple of bits of business from the women's tournament today. Heather Watson lost out to Matt's semi-finalist, Fiona Ferro.
Quarter-finalist.
Quarter-finalist, Fiona
Ferro. I've already
gone
big. Don't...
It had passed me by a bit that Fiona Ferro had won Palermo.
That's the only tournament she's played.
Maybe that's not as outlandish as I thought. Heather Watson played well today, and I felt sorry for her that she was the last of the Brits to go.
Mm.
And so it was, you know, she was the final nail in the British hopes coffin, and that's not her fault, because actually I thought she played about as well as any of them did in their first round exits, and that was a tough task for her today. But she was just outplayed when it mattered.
Yeah, and it meant that she got all the questions about what does this mean for British tennis and have we moved on and are we in crisis,
and
all that kind of thing.
She's not the best person, not really. I can understand why those went to her for obvious reasons, but she's not responsible for British tennis and she doesn't want to be, and she doesn't, I don't think she's the best person to talk about that kind of bigger picture stuff. Not sure who is. It's the first time since 2013 there have been no Brits into round two at the French Open, which actually
isn't that long
isn't
ago.
That's it. No.
And also, and there were some really tough draws.
I don't find it particularly significant in terms of these losses as being significant or signifying anything, because all of them, apart from Cameron Norrie, which when he's 2 sets to 1 up against the guy 150 in the world, I think he should have won. And I know that sounds harsh, but I do think he should have won on paper. All of the others, I think I kind of feel like, well, yeah, that could happen. They could lose that. Murray against Wawrinka, Contra against Goff, Evans against Nishikori, etc. The wider conversation as to where British tennis is right now, I just don't think is reflected necessarily in these particular results.
Agreed. Now, the last discussion point I wanted to raise from the women's tournament today involved Kristina Mladenovic and Laura Siegmund, who were playing on Chatrier. And Mladenovic was leading, I think, with a break in the opening set. And there was an incident where Mladenovic hit a short ball, a drop shot, I think. Siegmund ran for it. And there was quite a clear double bounce. And I say that reluctantly. On the replay, it was very, very clear. I often find double bounces extremely hard to pick up when I'm in a studio or something watching it and everyone around me is certain. I often think, oh my God, what are you eating more carrots than me or something? Are my eyes worse than I realize? Because I find them very hard. But on the replay, it was extremely clear. I don't think it's ever that clear in real time. So I cut the umpire some slack. But it was certainly clear to Mladenovic. It wasn't called, incidentally, and Siegmund won the point. And Mladenovic, would it be fair to say she capitulated?
Well, she was 5-1 up. 5-1 up, and she lost the next six games. Now, and she had set points, I think, as well in that set.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a perfect storm of events going against Mladenovic because, yeah, as you said, this happened at 5-1. I think it happened on set point, actually. So had it been called, Mladenovic would have won the set. But she did then compose herself and get in a position to win six more set points. She had six more set points after that. So there was ample opportunity for her to win the set. But, yes, it did sort of go downhill from that moment and she ended up losing in straight sets.
And it's the second slam in a row this has happened for Mladenovic in terms of, you know, a capitulation. And she, I'm sure, would point to extraneous circumstances on both occasions. Today, you know, she clearly felt very wronged. And look, she was wronged by that double bounce call. And in New York, she felt mistreated by the handling of being one of the Benoit pair 11. But, you know, people are dealing with stuff all the time, aren't they? On the court, off the court, people deal with stuff. And part of being a tennis player is not losing six games in a row when stuff happens.
I certainly wouldn't look at that point and think she has any reason to think that turned the match or that it should have turned the match.
Should Siegmund have held her hands up? Would Siegmund have known?
Here's the thing, I don't know that the answer to that because I think players, she lunged at the ball, she tried to get it, and she's fully outstretched arm. I don't know is the honest answer. A couple of the people that I was commentating with on the radio said absolutely she knew. Now, I can only take their word for that.
But I remember cricket pundits used to say that about getting a nick. When you've edged it, you always know, you always know. And then snicker got introduced and it turned out you don't always know.
Right.
Because you only know when you know. If you don't know when you don't know.
My feeling is...
I sound like Donald Rumsfeld, don't I?
My feeling is that if you believe you touched the or you knocked the ball into the ground or it was a double bounce, that you should own up for it. Absolutely, 100%. That is how I view it. And we have the James Blake memories from the Olympics relived in 2008 when he's playing Fernando Gonzalez and he hits the ball and Gonzalez clips it and Gonzalez admitted in our interview that he clipped it, but he didn't own up to it. Because stuff had happened in the match and he wasn't prepared to hold his hands up. And I think that was wrong. And I understand why James Blake, 12 years on, is still angry about it. Other people I speak to say, well, you know, it's up to the umpire to call these things, not a player. And if you give them one, the one you get back may be nothing like as important a time, etc. Or I just feel that if Siegmund did know, then I think she's in the wrong.
She said the reason she didn't call it was that if she'd then watched the replay and found that it wasn't a double bounce and she'd called it on herself, she would be so annoyed at herself for having called it. Now, I think when we discussed the James Blake and Fernando Gonzalez incident on that Olympics Relived episode, we kind of all said the exact opposite to that we would call it because if we saw the replay and it was a double bounce and we hadn't called it on ourselves, we would feel so guilty about kind of taking that point. But perhaps that's something that I just can't relate to, having never been in such a high stakes situation like that. And, you know, I don't want to get into some kind of big discussion about morality or whatever, but it should be the same in all situations. It should be the same playing in the park as playing on Chatrier. You should just do what you feel is right in that situation. But I can imagine that the circumstances do come into it. So, and I also don't think Siegmund is alone. I mean, I think Kiki Mladenovic herself said most players wouldn't have called that because you probably can't be completely 100% sure.
Another feature of that situation is that you kind of have to stand by the call, the decision you make in the moment. You never see a player sort of fail to own up to it in that split second that they have to make the decision, and then after 10, 15 seconds turn around and go, actually, I've thought about it, I did touch it, I knew all along, but I've just weighed it all up in my mind, have the point. That doesn't happen. Whatever your instinctive split second decision is, you have to double down on it and commit to it. So it might be that, you know, Laura Siegmund at all other moments of the day besides that split second would have done the right thing, but in the heat of that moment didn't do the right thing. David's not having any of it. Well, He's making a face at me.
All I can say is I think you're right about the doubling down in the moment thing, yes. The ex-players that I speak to say that Laura Siegmund is somebody who's scrapped for a career. She's had to. She's been terribly unlucky with injuries. She's managed to make a career. And frankly, if it means pushing the limits, including things like this, she will do it. That's what I'm told. I can only go with that.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
That match was second on the Philippe Chatrier court, and it was followed by Novak Djokovic against Mikhail Immer of Sweden. And blink, and you'd have missed it, because Djokovic would it be too far to say sublime today?
No, it wouldn't. He was imperious. For the first set, he won the first set 6-love after 20 minutes. And it was like he could predict every shot coming his way, and he had the perfect antidote to every one of them. Immer is a nice player, but he's quite similar to Djokovic in terms of stroke production and what he's trying to achieve. He's just nowhere near as good for a start. I also think he was pretty overwhelmed, but a bit nervous, and his opponent was hurting him. I was pretty disappointed the way Immer just kept failing to run after the ball because Djokovic was hitting drop shot after drop shot. He hit well over 20 drop shots in the match, and it was a measure of just how confident he felt, how it was a good tactic in the match for the most part. He was experimenting, I thought. He looked a totally different player to the man that we saw in Rome, for instance, when he said he won that title without playing that well. These conditions look like they suit him down to the ground. He was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, couldn't possibly have looked more comfortable. I know that Immer was a dream opponent for him in many ways, but still, I think to look that good, so often you see Djokovic go through the gears and sometimes look a bit scratchy in the opening rounds because he doesn't need to be any better than scratchy. And it felt like a statement today. Yeah.
It felt a statement to Nadal
and a statement to Dominic Thiem.
Yeah, it felt like 4 years ago when he was coming out and he was dropping 6-1 sets on Nadal and Murray and Federer in the first sets, you know, and he was just all business today, except that he was playing these drop shots, but he was toying with Imer, you know, that he was taking his best stuff and either rifling a winner down the line or hitting a drop shot lob combo. And there was just the one highlight moment where Imer hit one of the best through the leg shots that we've seen in a long while, and he has that memory to take with him, but that's basically about it.
It's always a very stark thing when a professional tennis player is struggling to even win games against another professional tennis player. It's sort of just a measure of the disparity and the difference between them. And Imer is a brilliant, brilliant tennis player, and he wasn't close to Novak Djokovic today. And it's kind of scary how dominant these top players can be when they play like that. And I agree, it seemed like the perfect conditions for Djokovic. It was indoors, right? It was under the roof.
Yeah.
And I do think these cold, damp conditions are quite good for Djokovic. People are comparing this French Open, if they're looking for a French Open, it's the 2016 one that they're comparing it to, which was very wet, and that was the one Djokovic won. The only slight caveat I would put is if it gets windy. We do know that Djokovic doesn't particularly like the wind, so I think he would hope that the wind stays down, and if it does, then it looks like these conditions are going to suit him.
Elsewhere in the men's tournament, Denis Shapovalov won. He had a bit of a wobble against Gilles Simon, but basically I think was very good today. We had the first ever victories from two sets to love down for both Andrei Rublev and Stefanos Tsitsipas. Rublev was against Sam Querrey on the Simon Mathieu court, 6-7, 6-7, 7-5, 6-4, 6-3. And Tsitsipas was on Suzanne Longlin, 4-6, 2-6, 6-1, 6-4, 6-4. It's a big moment, I think, when a player comes back from two sets to love down for the first time. And I think, it's quite different for each of them. I think for Rublev, it's kind of the last thing he wanted to be taken to five sets, given that he was playing the final in Hamburg a couple of days ago. And yes, he's on this incredible run and must be feeling just brimful of confidence, but he didn't need to be playing five sets against Sam Querrey today. For Tsitsipas, I feel like winning from a losing position perhaps erases just a little bit of the baggage he was accumulating from losing from winning positions, maybe.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not sure that a player can win a Grand Slam unless they've managed at some point in their career to come back from two sets to love down and know what that feels like, that sort of adversity, because I don't think you ever win your first Grand Slam without having some adversity along the 2 week journey. And this may not be this fortnight for them, but in terms of their development for the future, I think this is a really big deal. Because Tsitsipas, you alerted me to it, Catherine. When I was watching the first few games, he was 3-love up, and I'd stopped paying much attention. I was doing something else, and then the next thing I know, you messaged, and Tsitsipas is a set and a breakdown, and it's tail spinning away. He's getting time violations. He's getting his eyes looked at in a trainer visit and a medical timeout. And I thought he was going out at that point to Jaume Munar. He lost that set, and he just looked bereft. And when, with the build up of the baggage that you mentioned, of the loss to Čorić at the US Open, plus this one to Rublev when he's serving for the match the other day, I could see how this could end up having become a theme. But he dug in and he won. And for Rublev to win against a really difficult opponent, a guy with a massive serve and a huge forehand who's two sets to love up against him, again, it would be so easy to just feel a bit sorry for yourself and think, oh, you know, I won the Hamburg tournament. How's this happening? And I'm really tired now, you know. And he just didn't allow that to happen to him. And I think this is a really big deal for both of them.
Yeah, I would agree. I think they could both have done, you know, with winning a bit more easily than this. I think you're treading such a fine line when you play the week before a slam, and I think fatigue could come into it for both players later on in the tournament. So I'm not sure it's necessarily great news for their short-term prospects in this tournament, but long-term, I agree, it's a big hurdle to overcome coming back from two sets down. And they were quite different matches. Tsitsipas, he's so dramatic on the court.
You are watching someone have an existential crisis.
Yeah, and I just think when we're trying to figure out the differences between Tsitsipas outside the slams and inside the slams, I just think it's difficult to keep up that very dramatic, very draining on himself, almost stressful body language and demeanour that he's got on the court. And I don't know. I mean, he knows what's best for him, I'm sure. But I just think he knows better than me, but I just think he needs to calm down a bit.
Well, this is the thing, though. He spoke so warmly about his dad the other day, about how he'd had a week away from him, hadn't he? And then he comes back and he's back in Hamburg, and it sounds like his heart was singing again because his dad was back in town. It is lovely, really, in a way. But and then his dad's sitting there with his Stefanos Tsitsipas mask on.
Is it unhealthy? Oh, I'm so opposed to parents wearing paraphernalia branded with their children's name and or face.
Okay.
He's not the first, and I'm sure he won't be the last. No. But it is, I mean, look, it's is crass it, and it's...
Is rough. It unhealthy? I just don't know. I mean, I can't... Every time I sort of think, well, he just needs to distance himself a little bit more and get another coach, I just don't know. I mean, there are, I've seen other players like Wozniacki had a... Every time she tried to get somebody else, she came back to her dad, and she ended
but that's
up
because,
doing really well.
As I understand it, her dad never really left the scene. Mm. I don't think I think there's a lot of instances where it doesn't work, where getting somebody else in, but the parent/coach is still lurking in the background. I think it would need to be a clean break, which would obviously send Tsitsipas into emotional turmoil.
Every player
of separation
is,
anxiety.
Every player is different. So I am wary of putting my own version of what's sensible and what isn't, and what's healthy and what isn't, onto him. But it does occur to me that when he played that match and he finished that match, he hadn't got any clue what had just gone on, because he did his interview on court. And he's all wide-eyed and he's looking around and he can't quite believe what's just happened. It's all just amazing. But, you know, did I just do that? I find it endearing as well. And I felt really quite depressed in the first two sets when he was losing two sets to Love, because it's so clear how much it all means to him. And he looked like he was lost. And so that's why I think it's such a big deal that he found his way out.
Yeah, he thanked the fans afterwards to sort of demonstrate how out of it he was. I mean, there was literally about six people in the stadium. And just to say on his dad, I think I completely agree with you, David. It's an individual case, and, you know, who knows, really. But I watched Tsitsipas's matches, and I think he's very close to his dad actually causing him a problem on the court. I mean, he got a coaching violation today, and his dad is always talking and offering some kind of instruction or motivation. And I don't know, I don't think he's that far away from accumulating coaching violations and it genuinely causing him a problem in a match. And I don't know, I wouldn't want that to be the tipping point of their relationship. I just kind of hope that they can keep it under control before it gets that far. But it just stresses me out every time I watch it. I think particularly when there's no crowd, because you can just kind of hear it constantly back and forth.
It's like a proper soap opera, isn't it? So that way, I mean, I, with all due respect to Jaume Munar, who was so impressive today, I was so relieved that Tsitsipas came back and won it, because I'd found those first two sets quite upsetting to watch, actually. I found it really haunting watching Tsitsipas play that way and look that bereft on that court where I had one of the most exhilarating and uplifting tennis watching experiences of my life last year, sat alongside Matt watching that match between Tsitsipas and Wawrinka, and Tsitsipas was 50% of why that was one of my favourite ever tennis memories. It was like, I mean, it was, even for this year, it was just too dystopian. I think I said on the WhatsApp chat, it was like someone had put a dystopian Instagram filter over the scene. The fact that it was on the same court, but it was dark and gloomy, it almost looked foggy. It genuinely looked like a horror movie filter.
Whereas you also had that wonderful crowd there that day, didn't you, who were so invested. They were one of those crowds that just couldn't believe their luck back a year ago.
That was me and Matt. We weren't allowed to cheer, but we...
Thousands like
speak
you.
Speak for yourself, but I couldn't believe my luck.
No, and
it was
and
that good.
Whereas we saw one of those bird's eye cameras today on the screen at the end of set two, when Tsitsipas has just gone two sets love down, and you just see this deserted, utterly deserted stadium, apart from the two guys in the court and a few officials. And it just reminds you again how far life has changed.
We're still struggling. I mean, I know today was a bit less weird. Well done, Tuesday. But we are still struggling and debating and pondering on why it feels so weird in a way that the US Open didn't, and how much that's attributable to time of year. I had a message this evening from my friend Kay, who dabbles in tennis every now and then, mostly to sort of to support me. But, you know, she's passing interest in tennis, and she said, would any Grand Slam held in this kind of weather feel equally weird? And I didn't have an instant answer for that. I think the weather is a big feature of why it's weird, but I don't know how much it's down to that.
It contributes, but the place is deserted, really. Okay, there's 1,000 fans in every day. Everybody knows there's a pandemic. Everybody sitting around the court is wearing masks.
but a lot of that was applicable to the US Open, and it does feel substantially different. I'm going to read out the message that that my brother Math sent to our group that's still called Kiri Optimists. I mean, that's... Kiri Optimistic about WhatsApp spats with Karen Khachanov. I mean, that's a bleak situation.
If only they were on WhatsApp.
Oh, sorry, Twitter spats. Yeah. Well, maybe they are having WhatsApp spats as well. He said he was obviously pondering on the same issue, and he said, I'm thinking there is something significantly psychologically different about no crowds versus very small crowds. At the US Open, it was weird, but I've bizarrely felt more of a sense of shared occasion with the tennis watching community, all of us invisible behind the cameras, and intimacy with the players. With a tiny crowd, as at the French, I feel distanced by the presence of the spectators. This is something that's happening somewhere else, to other people, and the players in our responding to these spectators, and the fact that it's such a small crowd makes it feel like an underwhelming event.
So you're basically saying that you've got FOMO at this one and you haven't at the other one?
No, because I don't think that I want to be sitting in a mask in 8 degrees watching this tennis. I'm okay with watching it on the telly. Look, I'm not saying anything. That was just one theory posited.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating.
I think it's a really good theory. And I think it's also interesting to compare this to Rome.
Yes.
Because in Rome, we felt the crowds did make a difference and elevated the event. But I think where I come down on that is that the fact that they came in at the end of that tournament and felt like they elevated the most important matches. And also the way Italian fans support is probably a bit different, and they're so vocal and they made more of a noise than however many of them there were. You know, it felt like a bigger crowd, and this is more dispersed. There's more courts they can all go to. And it's it's very difficult to compare one to the other in that respect. But I completely agree that of all the tournaments we've had, this one has felt the weirdest to me. Maybe Kentucky. Kentucky was pretty weird because it was first, and it was you know, seeing these absolute stars in Serena Williams and Venus Williams in a, you know, what?
Oh, this
what
feels weirder
like
to me
car
than
park,
Lexington,
kind of. But this one feels much weirder, certainly, than the US Open and Rome.
I think
me.
It's going to win us over. We're only 3 days in. I think
I'm still enjoying it. It's still watching tennis and talking about it. It's still great.
I think there will be a moment where which swings it, which changes things.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's coming.
But I do think, whether it's down to what Matt says or not, I do think that shared experience feeling is missing. I think that's a big part of what feels odd about it to me. With the US Open, there was a sense of, I think maybe because it was so clear what the USTA had to put on the line and go through just to make this thing happen, there was a feeling of, this is going to be weird, folks, but let's all hunker down and enjoy it for what it is.
Well, they included everybody and told everybody what they were going
to
do
exactly,
and how they were going to
whereas
do it. Whereas the French Federation almost seemed to have just said, look, we're staging this event, you do what you like.
Yeah, and we don't, you know, and there was all that intrigue at the start about, you know, how they'd made the site COVID friendly and how they'd made it an enjoyable experience for players, even in spite of the restrictions. And you know, when the photos first emerged of the players' areas and the players' boxes and the hospitality suites and stuff, that created a level of interest and uniqueness that didn't make up for what we were missing. But it was something, and this is missing.
I know that,
all of that.
I know that Vasek Pospisil today lost his 19th
change of pace. Okay,
lost his 19th out of 20 clay court matches in his entire life. So this may have something to do with it. But he was asked today about the bubble experience as a comparison,
right, yeah.
And he said, "Yeah, it's much worse." At least for the players. The hotel we're staying at, it's tough. We don't have anything. The US Open, there was a much bigger effort, I felt, from the organisation to make the time in the bubble a little bit more comfortable for the players. That's sure. That's for sure. I mean, I think almost every player I've spoken to is sharing the same opinion. So.
Yeah, there is a very kind of French Open feel of, this is what it is, like it or lump it, you're lucky it's happening.
Yes.
And I think Shapovalov has said similar about the bubble today, but also said he doesn't want to talk about it until after the tournament. And I almost feel like that's one of the things that players are, quite rightly, I think, being appreciative of being able to play tennis, but therefore they're kind of maybe slightly holding back in some of their views about how they actually feel about it. And if they were, you know, if they were absolutely laying into it, we'd have loads to talk about, and that would kind of be a added layer of interest. But I think maybe it's partly what Mary was saying about whether or not to have fake crowd noise at the US Open, and I think Mary was kind of against it because she wanted everything to be as real and as authentic as possible. And if it's quiet, well, give me quiet then. And so perhaps the US Open was a kind of full tennis in a pandemic experience, and the French Open feels a little bit half and half in a way, and it's just not quite all in with the bubble, and it's not quite all in with the times, and therefore I just feel I don't quite know how to react to it, because I don't it doesn't feel like a normal Grand Slam, and yet it also doesn't feel like a completely different Grand Slam in the way that the US Open did. It's all just messing with my mind and my head a little bit.
That's why they're
doing
it,
Matt. You're in a Stefanos Tsitsipas type place.
let's just freak Matt out.
Matt doesn't need freaking out anymore. Last night's podcast was delayed because Matt encountered a sort of supernatural type beast while trying to edit.
It was a very, very traumatic half an hour, 45 minutes. I was happy as Larry editing the podcast, and suddenly became aware of some movement in my peripheral vision and quickly looked over and honestly saw a spider the size of my hand. I thought it had scurried under my bed. And I had a decision to make in this moment. Yes, I can probably carry on editing the podcast, knowing there's sort of evil incarnate hiding somewhere in my room. But I don't think I'll be able to sleep. So I did what I always do in a moment of crisis and messaged the Tennis Podcast WhatsApp group and said, what should I do about this? And Catherine, you were very quick to say, deal with the spider immediately. So I took that advice, and your second bit of advice was obviously to locate it. So I did do that, and it was under my chest of drawers.
This was not my first rodeo, Matt.
And I should say the other thing is, you know, we're obviously an animal-loving podcast, an animal-friendly podcast. I have absolutely no qualms whatsoever about killing spiders. And I also had to do this silently because I didn't want to wake up my parents. So it was a very difficult mission I had. So I sort of created a perimeter around the chest of drawers using a lot of ring binders containing my degree and my Wimbledon compendium and and my massive foreign language dictionaries, and eventually managed to lure it out and kill it and then crack on with the edit. But yeah,
it's a death we can all celebrate.
It was a bad evening.
Let's cross our fingers and toes that the same doesn't happen tonight. Spiders are definitely lone rangers, I think. There's never others where there's one. Let's go with that. Right then, we better let you go and edit. Anything else? I know there's been the kind of breaking maybe-ish news today from John Wertheim about the WTA finals. There is the prospect of them happening. We'd written off all hope because, well, we've been told the WTA had written off all hope, hadn't we? Steve Simon had said they were kind of vaguely looking at options after Shenzhen was ruled out as a venue, but that it was, I think, highly unlikely was the turn of phrase that he used at the time. But John Wertheim today reporting that they're looking at other potential options for hosting the finals. Prague is a city that has been mentioned, and a decision will be made and announced by the end of the French Open. And I really, really hope it happens.
The WTA Tour needs some more stuff. I mean, they've obviously been decimated because so much of the calendar that remains was going to be in China, and China have said we are not having any tournaments for the rest, any sporting events for the rest of the year. So, fingers crossed. I mean, it's a tough situation they've found themselves in. Many people would say, well, it's their own making, putting all their eggs in that basket, but who can foresee something quite like this? And if they can make something work, I mean, if it was Prague, I think that would be a fantastic city for a one-off WTA finals. I really do.
Yeah, agreed. So we'll keep you posted on that front today. Tomorrow's order of play, Lina Svitolina first up on Chatrier against Renata Zarazua of Mexico, Peronkova against Serena Williams, Rafael Nadal against Mackenzie McDonald, and then Alexander Zverev and Pierre Hugues-Bert, who returned to action with Nicolas Mahut today. And there was the most heartwarming little gif of them holding an umbrella today, which actually made me cry. I might have PMT or something, but it actually brought a tear to my eye. Stan Wawrinka and Dominic Kupfer on Suzanne Longlen, Jack Sock and Dominic Thiem, Simona Halep against countrywoman Irina Camelia Begu, and Caroline Garcia against Alexandra Sasnovich. That is Longlen. And Mathieu is Azarenka against Schmiedlova, Diego Schwartzman against Giustino. How will he have recovered from his 18-16 against Mute? Benoit Paire against Federico Coria, and Coco Gauff against M. Trevisan. What does the M stand for? Does anyone know? It really irritates me that the French Open website, you have to really delve to get someone's first name. Even if I clicked on the match now, it would only show their initial. So anyway, M. Trevisan, good luck against Coco Gauff tomorrow. That's what you've got on day four of the French Open. We'll be back with another daily pod tomorrow. We hope you're enjoying them. And thank you to Cam, our lovely, lovely mascot. If there's anyone out there in the world that hasn't seen Cam's video, sort it out. Go and watch it now. And Steve, we await Cam content. We'll see you tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.